So the events of a couple Sundays ago down in Waco at Twin Peaks was a big topic on the show in the days thereafter. As I'm sure you all know, and you probably recognize that it didn't take us very long to get to a point where we were way out of our league talking about this stuff, that we just did not have that kind of life experience that would enable us to do anything other than speculate about it. Well, here with us today is a guy who can do a little bit more than that because he has spent time on the inside working undercover. He has a book called Life in the Fishbowl, the true story of how a white cop infiltrated and took down 41 of the nation's most notorious Crips. He is Tegan Broadwater, and he joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And you're a listener.
Indeed.
I love it.
P1 week one.
So really? What were you thinking as you heard us try to make sense out of this? You must have been laughing your ass off.
I think that's about standard, right? That's par for the course. You kind of just kind of roll into a molehill and speculate and... That's all right.
And there's
That's
always,
what we do.
Yeah, and there's always somebody out there that has a hell of a lot more information than we do on whatever topic there is. But I don't think we've ever met anyone, when discussing anything like this that has the life experience that you have. And we started talking about, working undercover. And did you watch True Detective?
I didn't. I started HBO? To, but I didn't get a chance to really watch.
Okay. Well, there's a character on there, Matthew McConaughey's character, who was undercover for a while with some pretty nasty cats. And, got pretty deep within the organization and within Waco and talking about that scene. And that just, like Mike was saying, led us into other topics. And we were talking about how someone could do that first off and how that would affect their home life. If in fact, they did have a home life. And you seem to have all that. So what year did all this take place for you where you went undercover with the Crips?
2005 is when it started.
All right, now, what were you at the time? Were you a cop?
I was a cop. I was at Fort Worth PD, working the narcotics section.
Okay.
And then there was a problematic area in the east side of Fort Worth that was gang-ridden type of area that was seemingly impenetrable by typical police type of operations. We did jump outs and raids and traffic stops and all kinds of stuff. And at some point, it just became a wacky idea of mine to just try to blow it up from the inside out.
Oh, this was your idea. Is this in stop six down there?
Stop six would be Bloods. I'm on the other side, so we're more southeast, on the 35 side, not on the 820 side. So,
and what would lead you to believe that a white guy could infiltrate 99.99% black gang?
Yeah, I would assume so. Well, I went in and stood out as the way that I kind of fit in. I didn't pretend to know a lot about the gang life. I just pretended to be a big-time dealer who had my source busted and needed to try to get my game started again. So I was over there trying to procure some help. That's the reason I said I was from the west side of town near TCU so that there wasn't any kind of an insinuation of competition. It was more like an opportunity for them, and utilized the drug trade to kind of get into and take notes about the gang life that they were exhibiting there because... you could spin your wheels all day trying to fight drugs, and you it's a necessary thing to do. It's not like we're winning the war on drugs, but eliminating a lot of the violence and stuff that's associated with the drug trade, especially with gangs of different sorts, is more important in this particular case.
So you, a white guy with reddish hair, starts showing up on the streets over there one day saying, I'm trying to do some business over by TCU. My guy got popped. I need some help.
Yeah.
I mean, that...
More or less.
That...
How did they not shoot you on site?
Don't you have to have an initial contact or a connection?
Yeah. I mean, I'd been utilizing informants for some time, and, I'd gone down there a couple of times with informants, too, but it's... It was very cautiously... taken. I didn't just jump in and try to make my first buy and then everybody just cried at my window and sold to me. So that wasn't the idea. I think the thing that worked in my favor the most was that I had planned on making it kind of a long-term deal. So it was easy for me to say no when people were trying to ask me for identification or do I want to do this deal or that deal? I made it very easy to say no. You know, an ambitious cop would typically try to take advantage of every opportunity he could to get further through a deal. And I was quick to just say, no, if you don't want to do the deal my way, then because I'm supposed to be the experienced dealer, then I'm going to move on. There's plenty of other opportunities for me. I'm not going to sit here and you know, take the 10 questions you have for me.
So it starts in 05. What's the timeline for the end game of all this to where you go out from undercover?
It was, I went in deep in 2005 and went 18 months until 2007. And that was the time. I didn't know when the end would be. I kind of had a mapped out kind of a goal, you know, with one of the kingpins as my goal, who was doing about $250,000 a week in product.
Wow.
And he was still the Fort Worth kingpin. He's not even the guy in Mexico. So the organization was really tight knit and really taking over that whole part of the city, really.
So how long did it take, you know, from when you go in 2005 to establish some sort of foothold and you got a little confidence thinking this is moving in the right direction?
At what point did
Was this months? Was it weeks? Was it?
Oh, yeah. Like I said, I took my time. So as little bitty deals, what I did in principle was I would go to the street level guys who were the only contacts I could make initially.
Yeah.
And tell them I was looking for powder cocaine, and they only had crack on those streets, so they couldn't really help me. But I would hook them up with, you know, buy $100 of their stuff, and I'll say, look, I'll do my best to move your stuff, too, just as a favor, but ultimately was looking for their source who would have the powder before it was cooked down to crack.
Mm-hmm.
And that took, you know, I think over the course of a couple of months, I was starting to get introduced to other bad guys by bad guys. And it wasn't necessarily going down there with an informant or whatever. It was, you know, after a few months, they were swearing by me to other bad guys. And, and I was kind of making my headway at that point.
And you'd be down there like every day?
I was down there every day. That was part of what I did was if I wasn't doing business and I knew somebody that may not have been down there, I would go down there and ask for them just to put myself in their business and just hang out. You know, so I'd go down there with a
just
couple
to show
of
your face in the place.
Yeah.
You would go down there with a couple of 40s?
Oh, yeah. You know, you got to hang out. It's like a business, you know. You got to kind of garner the relationships. And, you know.
Got to work the room a little bit.
Did you have a burner phone? You surely didn't have your own phone that you're calling your family.
I have the same phone number to this day.
You're kidding me.
I'd rather know about it than not know about it. You know what I mean? So, to this day, I keep the same phone number.
Wow. All right, now, when you're not down there, do you have to go back and talk to, you know, your bosses on the force or the guys over you on the force and keep them wired into all this?
I did. I had one supervisor that really kind of mitigated exposing a lot of what I was doing because I kind of shared my long-term goal with him. And you know, since the 70s and 80s, it's not really a typical operation to go deep cover anymore. It's just too much liability involved with that kind of stuff. But he really trusted me. So he kind of stood in between me and the requirement to make reports and stuff like that. So I kept my notes and we turned in evidence, but there wasn't any trace of exactly what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And at about 7 months in, I was running out of resources and money. I was going in there with giant stacks of ones with 620s on the top, you know, because I'm working on a Fort Worth PD narcotic budget.
Yeah.
And kept telling these guys how big time I am, and I'm buying these, you know, I'll buy a $400 sample from you, but that only lasts for so long before they call BS on you.
Yeah.
So eventually I shopped it to the feds, and the FBI Gang and Violent Crimes Task Force took me under their wing, and I was reassigned to the FBI, and there, you know, I was able to get my car with the cameras and the $6,000-$8,000 you want to buy this, whatever, how much money you need. They were letting me.
So that's when everything changed.
Yeah, that was definitely a corner turn. It was kind of a handshake and a slap at the same time. Once I took that gig, they assigned me to an FBI agent who was busy prosecuting another case. So she was stuck for about the first two and a half or three months giving me the resources I needed, but I was just roving alone at that point. I had no oversight or anything. My PD thought I was with the FBI, and the FBI assumed I had a PD, and I'm just trying to keep the thing going until somebody can give me some help.
This is Tegan Broadwater, who went undercover with the Crips back in the mid-2000s and by yourself, which is strange in itself, a white police officer going into Fort Worth and dealing with these dangerous cats. So what was the first time that you saw hardcore, or did you see hardcore violence, and you're sitting there as a police officer going, I can't do anything about it?
Well, a few months in, there was an incident where the book actually kind of opens up, and I had brought an informant with me and a friend of the informant who was involved with Los Zetas, and he was actually legit.
The Zetas?
Yeah.
Those badass dudes? That-
yeah. So, and he was for real laying low and trying to stay away from the feds and kind of retiring himself, and had moved up here from south of Austin. And it was one of those quirky deals where, you know, the informant I had with me was driving me nuts, and I decided I was going to just proceed anyway with this caboose. And it ended up really riling up the guy that I was there. I was supposed to buy a key and get in and get out and get it done. And they ended up opening the door behind the burglar bar cage and greeted me and everybody else with a shotgun. And it wasn't even the guy I was supposed to meet. It was a guy I didn't recognize. And he's cussing and screaming and sweating and got the shotgun, you know, fixed on me and them. So, again, like you said, as a police officer to react, it's not something I can necessarily do. I have, you know, collateral damage behind me that I can't put at risk. And so I'm talking him down. They eventually get the dealer I'm there to meet, comes up to the door and lets us in, talks the guy down, and there's a bunch of skirmish still. Everybody's yelling, and this Zeta walks in, and the guy doesn't recognize him, and my guy says, well, you know, who's this guy? And then it riles up the shotgun player again, and he starts going nuts. And in absolutely no time, this guy, Carlos, ends up pulling a pistol out of his waistband that I was apparently unaware of.
Is this the Zeta?
Yeah.
Okay.
Shoves it right in the guy's mouth and pins him against the wall and starts screaming in Spanish. And so there's Tegan, who's not bilingual either, sitting there with my informant and his supposed friend, who's, you know, just snafuing the entire deal as far as I was concerned. I thought we were going to be done and cooked at that point. I stepped on the shotgun so that nobody could pick it up. And everybody's trying to talk in Spanish and English and trying to just chill it all out because, again, the guy was, you know, jumped up on something.
God, what a chaotic scene that must have been.
Yeah, it was lunacy. But he eventually pulled it out, and the guy's spitting teeth and blood in the sink. And obviously I'm like, hey, you're going to excuse us. We're going to get out of here. And I kept wondering if it was a deal breaker or an enhancement. And apparently it gave me a little street cred after that. And I think we, you know, it kind of elevated somewhat of the status just because of the fact that I didn't necessarily freak out over it.
Yeah.
You know, externally anyway.
Yeah. I'm sure internally you are. All right, let's take a break because I want to get into, at the time, you had a son, correct?
That's correct.
And you had to go home at night to this family?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to get into that side of things and then clearly how everything ended up on you arresting 41 or taking down 41 of these Crips who eventually went to a federal prison. This is Tegan Broadwater.
What we're about to do here is being brought to you by
American Leak Detection.
And what we're about to do here is listen to a little bit more of the fascinating story of Tegan Broadwater undercover with the Crips and busted 41 of them as detailed in his book, Life in the Fishbowl. All right, now, we've gotten into probably just a little chip off the iceberg of your time and activities undercover. Sure. Just thumbing through the book here, number one, I can't believe how well you seem to have ingratiated yourself into that scene. That couldn't have been easy to do.
Well, no. I think my technique, so to speak, for actually getting in was making sure that I took a lot of my own personality with me. You know, there's a lot of guys that try to train for different types of situations and to engage in certain personas and stuff. And I've just kind of thought it would be a lot easier for me to be what Tegan would be if Tegan actually had some of these sociopathic tendencies and just go forward with that. So I felt at ease. I learned a lot about these guys from the inside, and it was remarkable to learn. You know, we'd sit and shoot the breeze, you know, sharing a beer. They'd be playing Madden. They're talking about chicks. They're talking about Terrell Owens or whatever. You know, so outside the fact that if you cross them, they're going to launch rounds into your house, and they, you know, are selling dope for a living, they were dudes. Otherwise.
Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah, there's nothing that separates you outside of probably a lack of education and a moral compass.
Right.
You know,
that seems to be the smartest thing to do is just imagine yourself as a drug dealer, because if it would seem to me that if you tried to pull off a persona or acting, you can slip in and out of that accidentally. And people that are pretty good, have pretty good perception of other people, could probably see that it was false.
Yeah.
And compromise yourself.
Especially keen people in the drug trade. I mean, they're going to really know because they're already suspicious. You know, just me walking in the room, you're already going to have, you know, extra eyes and ears. So.
And then at night, you got to go home. You got to put all that aside and go home into a normal scene with your wife.
Right.
You have kids at that time, at this time?
I did. I had, my son was about 11 at the time. He wasn't old enough to really know. My wife, of course, was. I would say she was, you know, she was my yang at that point, you know, because, you know, the more of this, you know, getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning after you pick up a call in the cell and you're running out, somebody's, you know, somebody's picking up a load or whatever, or they want to hang out or you need to do something at all hours. It really disrupts life, you know, for sure. When my son was more unaware, she was the one that was keenly aware of.
Yeah. I mean,
how much detail could you disclose to her, though?
I disclosed to her, and she'll even tell you, I disclosed to her and she's very curious about stuff that's going on, but I disclosed as much as was reasonable to not totally upset her.
I'm sure that, you know, you're not sharing the shotgun and the teeth story. And,
no.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point in it because you're going home. I mean, you just said that you're living essentially a double life and you have another personality for 9-10 hours during the day and sometimes at night.
Right.
But then you got to go home and take the trash out and do homework and tell your wife that she looks good. And I mean, all this just normal stuff that you know, I deal with right now every single day. And this is my life, 9 to 5. My life is coming here and being a jackass.
Not selling
cocaine.
It's
pretty easy to go home and just be that guy, you know, still, you know, with the family. But for you, man, that had to have been, for 18 months, incredibly strange and maybe a living hell.
Well, it was surreal, and there was a lot of anxiety. I wouldn't say necessarily depression, but just the anxiety and the stress of always being on was difficult. And after, you know, after that first year, I mean, she came, you know, and started drawing lines about you've either got to snap to it and be able to treat the family like you're supposed to. Or because things are changing to the extent that she's not recognizing me anymore, which was part of the difficulty of being able to slide in and out of my persona, because it was still kind of me.
Yeah.
My name was even T. I mean, it was just, I kept everything close and relatable to my own personality, got to know a lot of these guys. And so coming home, it's not like you take off the jacket and just relax and become yourself again. You're so closely related to your own personality that there's really nothing really to turn off, and you're expecting a call within the few hours, and you're just trying to squeeze in a good dinner and, you know, getting home. The weirdest part was, you know, this isn't a Donnie Brasco where they, you know, they move you 2 states away and they put you under. I mean, this this happened in my backyard, so we're still going to the mall, for heaven's sake. You know, if I'm going to the mall on a Saturday, we have plans about how we're going to separate so that we're not recognized. If I know the family member or somebody that I see in the city that I'm actually doing this mess in.
Did you ever see anybody?
Happen? Yeah. One time. And it, you know, like I said, my son probably enjoyed it. I don't even know if he knew the difference. Like I said, we didn't go into detail, but my wife is, you know, certainly smart enough to know that we just would walk and kind of spread apart gradually as if we had just been kind of passing one another.
Right. And so you just like kind of broke off, and she probably had no, oh, geez, oh, Pete. That's so
weird. You had to be able to toggle back and forth just on the fly in an instant.
Yeah, you have to. But like I said, that wasn't difficult. The difficulty was really taking the fine line that I'd drawn between my persona and my true self.
Yeah.
You know, that line, the broader it becomes, the more difficult it might be when you're under and working with these gangbangers, but it makes it more difficult to discern really what type of attitude you have and what type of emotions you're sharing when you're barely a different person from when you just got back from the hood, you know?
You mentioned the phone call at 2 in the morning was that part of the line that was drawn? Stop taking the phone calls. I mean, was there ever a phone call that you turned down?
No.
You always answered.
No, I always answered. She was just starting to not recognize me as the person she married, and that's basically where it was put to me. She even has a section in the book, and we had so much curiosity from people that were giving input to, about the book, about how she could stand it. You know, she's the, you know, she's the hero of the whole game, because without her emotional support and the times when she can stand you up and say, hey, slap, slap, you know, you need to
wake up, bud.
Yeah, come back to life here a little bit. I mean, it was really a necessity, you know, for me.
So now you brought down 41 of these guys. Did they all come down at once? Was there like this big bust where they go in there and round them up after you had enough on them, or how did that work?
Yeah, we had 51 rounded up total. 41 are the ones that went federally, and we had about 200 and some plus law enforcement, from the feds to local guys. Had guys coming in from Arlington, SWAT teams, everybody. We just coordinated a massive raid. And
you were on hand for this.
I was on hand. It was quite exciting. Now, my experience, you know, through law enforcement was, you know, going through the door on these raids. So at this point, being part of the coordination team and then having all these different targets to be hit all simultaneously, and then just hoping that you're snagging these guys and finding evidence and things like that, was, and not really having any control over the actual process of breaking down the door and grabbing them myself, was a little bit stressful.
So you actually had moments that when the arrests were being made, that you had to face these guys that you were friends with and had befriended for 18 months, and you were found out at that point?
Yeah, that was...
Oh, my God. I can't imagine.
That was one of the more fascinating parts, you know, outside. Once we rounded them up, which also took a while because you don't get them all the first try. So then you've got the rumors going around that, okay, T's not T, this is something else, and you got guys on the run and people in the hood now knowing who I am, so I'm worried about getting them rounded up.
Did you have a form of Stockholm syndrome where you almost felt sorry for these guys?
No question.
You did? Yeah. So you were friends with them at this point, or as close to friends as you could be.
Yeah, there were a handful that I held high hopes that would plead out and share information and get the absolute best deal. And I was going to do everything I could to take care of them, you know, and there were a few that did that. And there were a few that I really had hoped would that didn't. And, you know, they got hammered because, you know, this federal time is not a game.
Did you tell any of these guys that look, you know, what's happened's happened, but I like you, and if you'll plead out, I'll do the best I can for you?
Yeah, I had either one reaction or another. The two types of reactions I had was they didn't want to talk to me at all because they were just pissed, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would be sitting on one side of the table with the FBI agent and talking to them, and the FBI agent would be grilling them about something, and they would just look at me and say, that's not true. T, tell them. It's not true. You know me, T, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wow, they can't separate me. You know, they see me and, you know, I'm not sitting there in a uniform or anything. They know me as T. And so they still, even sitting across the table in the federal jail, isn't kind of getting through the head. And again, I did have quite a bit of sympathy for them. It's a reason why they're in prison, but it's not an excuse to keep them out.
Did you see through it all too? And, you know, it's a huge topic of conversation right now. Yeah, they're doing bad things, but how societal it all is and just how they're bred into this lifestyle, and from the age of 10, 11, 12, maybe even younger than that, they get involved in the game. And, you know, it's a lifestyle where you mentioned that you're living over there by TCU or whatever, how it just, you know, it's nature versus nurture, essentially. And you see it right in front of your face, how these guys, it's a dead-end road when they're born.
Right. Well... And that's why the profits of the book are going to organizations that mentor children of incarcerated or murdered parents. Because ultimately, the only way that you're going to keep these operations from being necessary is to mentor these kids from an early age and get them turned around, because most of them don't have dads or father figures.
Sure.
And so it seems kind of cliche, but, you know, the gang offers you a familial type of relationship. And a lot of these kids don't have that at home. They don't have the type of discipline. And then they go to jail and they get out and they're 30-something and they still don't know how to write a check or mm-hmm. have a budget or are educated enough to get X job. They don't know how to dress up or even fill out an application. They're starting from scratch, and so it's just an endless cycle. And
we saw that on The Wire. Did you like The Wire?
Yes. Yeah. No, I honestly had a hard time watching The Wire because that's all I did all day. And then yeah. I would come home and start watching a couple episodes like, man, I'm done. I'm done.
I live this. I can't watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, was there, were you, you know, throughout your time there, were you always carrying some form of weapon or did you have your, not, I mean, did you have your service weapon on you? Or was that,
no,
you
I
couldn't
had, no.
really.
Well, no, I had a little five-shot revolver that I kept with me. And I still carry it to this day. It's just, it's not, you know, you had a lot of people that are like, well, how do you keep the weapon on you and not get searched or all this kind of jazz? Or how do you not take drugs? And those are the types of questions I get. But again, I controlled the situation because I am supposed to be the big time dealer coming over and making a little parallel jump into this other game. So
you never had to like smoke crack with these guys or anything like that while
no.
they're, were they all doing it around you and stuff?
No. Not all of them. Now, once you get to a certain level, you're talking about people doing business. So they're not on crack. They're doing business. They're actually
sure.
they're sitting
yeah.
there in the living room.
Like The Wire.
Counting $1 million in the living room floor. I mean, it's nutso. But I told them I was on parole and had a parole card. But again, having the card meant nothing because I was never going to show them that. They could either believe
Did you
it
have one?
Or not. Yeah, I had one.
Okay.
I even went to the little piss test every once in a while. I went downtown and saw a couple of them there. I'd stand in line to go take a piss test, you know, just so it would just kind of bolster
make it
the
look
whole
cool.
thing. Yeah, this is part of the deal.
And everybody down there, did they know who you were? Or is this one of these deals where the fewer people that knew what was going on, the better?
Yes. No one really knew until this started coming to a head. And that's why I said that supervisor that I had in the narcotics section originally really protected this from blowing up in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know, when this thing ended, I found such a passion and learned so much from this. At, you know, flying by the seat of your pants, you learn the good and the bad. And we tried to do another one of these things. And I was spending time in Freeport, and they were shipping stuff across, and it was Mexican gangs, and it was coming straight up 35. And they assigned me a small team of people that we were going to put together this awesome blown-up operation again. And, you know, 2 months into it, it was just outrageous how many people had their fingers and stuff. And it just doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Things don't fly.
Were you amazed at the organization? I think typically people think of these criminal organizations as either look at it one or two ways, that they're bumbling fools or that they are highly organized. Did you see the highly organized side of things once you got to a certain level?
Yeah, absolutely. Really smart guys, obviously leveraging their intelligence the wrong direction. But once you get to a level, somebody... you know, making $1 million a month, it's hard to convince them that, hey, if you get a real job, you could do real well for yourself.
Where did they live, the guys that were making that kind of money? So did you reach that level where you were friendly with dudes like that?
Mm-hmm.
And were they just, did they live in normal, I mean, yep. I just don't imagine them living down in the rough areas of Fort Worth.
They do. That's where they grew up. And they were talking about gangs. I'm just using the drug angle to get into the gang lifestyle. So these guys were really into the gang stuff. I mean, when we rounded all these fools up, you know, instead of saying, hey, if you want to make good on this and cut some of your sentence short, you're going to need good information. It's not about telling me where another dope house is. That doesn't help me.
Yeah.
What we did was we solved 9 cold case murders.
Wow. Because
all these guys, you know, some of these guys that I was dealing with at the time, of course, I didn't know it, but were responsible for, you know, several murders. And these guys really played it for real.
Yeah.
So those are the types. And again, a lot of the guys at the top are really smart. You got to know how to keep your hands off stuff. And that's why it's so hard to get to them. There's usually not enough police resources or patience to take a long-term project like this and see it to the end. There's just too much time put into it, and there's too much liability sending someone like me in to do something like that.
Are you, I mean, clearly you're cool with everything. You've got a book out. Your name is here. You're on the radio. Is there any post, I mean, it's been a decade now since this has all gone down.
Yeah.
Did you walk around the first few months or first few years and always looking over your shoulder? And
yeah, we had some direct threats, you know, over the first year, and my wife never stayed home by herself. And if I was working late, she would just sleep in my truck with me until we were done. We, you know, I was talking about, we camped out on one of my part times with my son, and she's setting up in my truck, you know, watching movies like a little adventure, you know, because again, he doesn't know.
Yeah.
But it was, it was something at this point that now that we've turned this around, it's not a story about Batman. I mean, I know Batman, but I don't make myself out to be some kind of hero in the book. It's real. So there's plenty of screw-ups in there as well as, you know, the realistic aspects of what was more difficult to accomplish. But ultimately, it's generally supposed to benefit the neighborhoods, you know, that were directly affected by this stuff. So the monies from these books are going straight back to help the communities that were affected by these people that are taken off the streets. And we left 104 kids now without at least one parent. So again, the whole purpose behind the book is not to make me look awesome. Mm-hmm. It's to bring light to the fact that this type of cycle can be turned around if we pay attention to what the problems are, which you brought up yourself. I mean, it's kind of a commonly known thing that if you are brought up in that type of environment and these are your only choices and you have no mentoring options from somebody that can actually show you that you're capable of doing something better, then you end up being lost. So that's the whole purpose of the book. And I can only hope that they wouldn't come kill me because it's for the good cause.
Yeah. The book is Life in the Fishbowl. It's Tegan Broadwater. And this is available Barnes & Noble.
It's on Amazon. Send a tweet out with the link to buy it online right now.
Thank you. Cool. Barnes & Noble and Amazon are best places to get it. Yes, sir.
Awesome. Dude.
Great stuff, man.
Fascinating. Thank you so
much. Amazing story.
Yeah, it's an honor
to be here. Enjoyed having you on.
Yeah, thanks for being a P1 too, man.
Yes.
Very cool.
Tegan Broadwater there, the author of Life in the Fishbowl. Community Quick Hits coming up here.